This summer, saddle up with the only sportsbook where you can bet on horse racing, FanDuel. Right now, new customers can get a no-sweat first bet up to $500. That's right, you'll get up to $500 back in racing credit if your first horse racing bet doesn't win. With FanDuel Sportsbook, you can even watch and bet select races live right in the app. So, bet horse racing on the same app where you bet all your other favorite sports. FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Just download the app or go to FanDuel.com/horses to score your no-sweat bet up to $500. 21 plus and present in Ohio. Offer valid on first real money wager of $5 or more. Verified FD racing account required. Bonus issued in non-withdrawable racing site credit that expires 7 days after issuance. Max refund $500. Restrictions apply. See terms at racing.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Now, it's a very big week coming up on the EU front. This week, there's going to be the first summit of European leaders, at least the first summit in person, in 6 or 7 months, where European leaders have some pretty big decisions in front of them, including how exactly the EU's proposed COVID-19 recovery fund should work and whether there should be some strings attached. So what exact threats does that present to Ireland? What opportunities are there? And how exactly is it all going to work? We're joined now on Skype by Mairead McGuinness, MEP, First Vice President of the European Parliament. Mairead, good afternoon, and thanks very much for speaking to us this lunch. Time. Just before we talk too much about the upcoming agenda, just because other MEPs and their movements and their whereabouts have been the result of quite a lot of media reporting in the last couple of days, I know that you've been over and back between Brussels and your home in the northeast. Have you been self-isolating for all the time that you've been back from Brussels?
Yes, I have. I've been over, I think, since the 8th of June, where the Parliament tried to, you know, recover to some sort of normality. And I'm COVID tested before I leave. I'm in Brussels now, by the way, but when I'm traveling, I get the COVID test and then I go home. So I'm very conscious of the public health requirements. And indeed, a lot of members of the Parliament who are here are required to have a COVID test before they go back to their member state. And that might be something that the government could look at, so that there is some certainty that the infection is under control and not going to get out of control because of travel. Because people are concerned that as we return to normal, whether it's in Belgium or Ireland or wherever, that people's guard will drop. Mm. For example, yesterday in Brussels, it was very noticeable that people are wearing masks. Because it's now mandatory in shops that people do that. And in fact, in the European Parliament, the only place that I can take a mask off is in my own office when I'm on my own. But in any other building, or rather section of the building, whether it's a big meeting room or a small meeting room, you have physical distancing and everyone wears a mask.
Is that included in the hemicycle? So if you're in the actual parliamentary chamber itself, you have to wear a mask?
In the hemicycle itself. Like I chaired two debates this week. I entered the building or the hemicycle at the podium with a mask on. I'm allowed to take it off when I'm speaking. Some members will keep it on when they're speaking, but that can be difficult for interpreters. So it is very strict in the Parliament. And for example, when I go in tomorrow morning, I'm temperature checked at the door. And if there's any difficulty, which thankfully there hasn't, people are not allowed into the building. When you enter then, there is a one-way system. So you've got to walk on one side of a corridor and there are sanitation points at every, if you like, couple of hundred yards. Mm. And I suppose that's because when this struck in March, the president of the Parliament, David Sassoli, he made some very strong but correct decisions. First of all, he stopped just going to Strasbourg, so everybody went home in March. And then as the Parliament reopened, he has introduced all of these checks and controls, including, for example, that there's a minimum number of staff in the building at any one time, and staff who are not required to be in the building can work from home.
It sounds fairly rigorous, all in all.
It is very rigorous, but it's also correct. I mean, on the other hand, there is a proposal that we go back to Strasbourg in September. And I think a lot of us are cautious about that. I think we would want to be sure that there is a risk assessment done maybe in the end of August to make sure that if we do move, and remember, there are people moving from all parts of Europe to a one destination, that we do it with absolute certainty that the public health guidelines and the health of our staff would be secured. Although I understand that in September, again, we will probably have staff working remotely. And we've had an interesting study carried out of staff who are working remotely. And by and large, a lot of staff, while anxious in the beginning, have found it quite an interesting and useful exercise. And there's been some who found their well-being improved by it. So, more than any other business, I think that in the business of parliaments, we may see more flexibility of where people work from. But I would say that the one area that is not, I think, 100% effective is that those members who don't come to Brussels cannot make a presentation directly to the chamber on a debate. So there is, in a sense, a bit of, you know, a divide between those who are physically present and those that are not. And I think that would have to change if in September we still have members who cannot travel because of age reasons or because of some sort of vulnerability, that they shouldn't be, if you like, disenfranchised.
Sure.
And we are, and on voting, we vote remotely. I mean, even in, when I'm physically here, I have to go back to my office to fill out an electronic vote. So an awful lot has changed.
It certainly seems fairly rigorous, all right. Just as a matter of clarity, when you mentioned that you get temperature tests on the way into the building, when you say that you've been tested before you come home, is that a test that's conducted by the Parliament authorities, or is there civil authorities that do a test, or have you just been opting in to do that, or what does that entail?
The Parliament has given us the contacts with the lab who do the testing. And again, it was on demand because members wanted to have this test done. I think it's very reassuring for two reasons. For myself, obviously, that I'm not bringing any infection anywhere and that I'm well. But equally, when I'm going home to my family, that I'm well. And one of the reasons I would have stayed in Brussels this weekend is that the Belgian authorities have Ireland in the red zone. So there's a green, amber, red.
Yeah.
So that people, because we now have a strong quarantine thing, they've now put Ireland in the red zone. And while as a member of parliament, I would be able to travel into Belgium and go to the parliament because we have certificates to allow us to do that. It just seemed not to test the system tomorrow morning at God's hour when I have a very early meeting. So it's just to be pragmatic.
This might seem like a curiosity, and I'm not trying to make trivia of it, but if Ireland is on Belgium's red list, does that mean then that when Micheál Martin goes to attend this European Council summit on Thursday and Friday, and presumably he'll have Thomas Byrne as his junior minister in tow as well, that he would be officially required then to spend, or at least under the Irish government's guidance, he'd have to spend 2 weeks at home self-isolating afterwards?
I don't think so. And I think it's because obviously he's the Taoiseach, and there are certain professions and occupations that are essential workers. So we know some of those already in terms of people who work in the food industry or work in supermarkets or whatever. I think it's really important that the Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, is physically in Brussels this week. You mentioned that in your intro. And the reason why it's important is that, you know, teleconferencing works. But when you're trying to do a deal, when you're trying to look at what people are really thinking, it's better to be in the room. So it is a first. For example, this week, the German Chancellor, on her first visit outside Germany, really since the pandemic, came to the European Parliament. She was physically present in the Parliament. And I think she did that for two reasons. One, as a sign to the Parliament that she's listening to our demands around the future budget, but also as a sign to say that, you know, Germany has taken over the presidency of the European Union. She is now in the hot seat, if you like, as the person who will have to get both a budget and a recovery package over the line. And she seems very determined to do that. And I suppose a lot of people will be relying on the German Chancellor's, I suppose, capacity and experience to negotiate really tricky issues with other leaders who thus far have not been yielding much on some very sensitive topics.
Well, let's talk a little bit then about the discussions that are going to happen this week, because I think there's probably a sense ever since Angela Merkel and Emmanuel Macron, since they had their bilateral meeting where they seemed to break the deadlock around how exactly some EU funds to deal with COVID-19 were going to work, there's probably been a sense that that's been a fait accompli. Generally, the idea was that instead of the EU having so-called corona bonds, that basically members would have to increase their contributions to the EU budget, but then the EU centrally would be able to borrow and then issue that money as grants to make sure the countries were able to get what they needed. Is that something of a fait accompli now, or are there still some resistance to that that will have to be ironed out this weekend?
Well, there's lots of things to be ironed out. But just to begin with the Franco-German announcement, I think that was pivotal, although the Chancellor was asked about that in the Parliament this week and more or less saying, why should the two countries be the only ones to have, got together on this? And her answer was, well, if Germany and France can't agree on it, what hope for the rest? So I think she was quite wise on that. There's two issues here. One is a realisation that in the beginning of this pandemic, Europe really didn't look after each other, that Italy and Spain to some extent felt left behind. There was a calculation then done about the economic plus the social consequences of the pandemic, and it is enormous, and we're seeing that in Ireland as well, and a belief that there was a really big package was needed to kickstart the economies and to, if you like, invest in projects that are future oriented, like digitalization and the green economy. But equally, there's this discussion about the next budget. Now, I'm in Parliament a while, and every single debate about a budget, the MFF, has been fraught.
I mean, they're giant. Remember, they're seven-year projects. They take ages to get over the line.
And they're over $1 trillion. And, you know, every member state, you know, wants something out of it and wants to get something that they perhaps haven't got in the past. I remember my first engagement was Tony Blair as Prime Minister. So now we're in a different scenario. I think it would be difficult, even if we hadn't had the pandemic, this budget discussion. But now we have two big pots of money on the table and a lot of disagreements still. So if you look at the big package you've mentioned, the 750 billion, most of this is, if you like, to go by way of grants rather than loans to the hardest hit member states.
And is that more along the lines of what you would consider to be disaster aid rather than it being some sort of investment for future development, that kind of thing?
Well, I think no, it would have to be invested in projects with some return, because I think the whole idea of this is not to just go back to where we were, but to rise us beyond it. The big question about grants is that some member states, like the Dutch, don't believe in grants. They believe, yes, low interest loans are acceptable, but they're not too happy with grants. There's also a debate on the, if you like, the key that will be used to allocate the funds. And there are some disagreements between member states and that. There are then a discussion around how is this money repaid? So it's borrowed by the Commission. It has to be repaid. Mm. And again, there are some who would say this needs rather to be repaid earlier rather than stretched over seven or longer years. And that we need to find own resources to finance the repayment of these big loans. Mm. So that's on that side, the recovery package. On the budget itself, our concern in the Parliament is that the budget is our, you know, the given. We know it's there and it funds all our usual policies. We are fearful, and I think rightly so, of a trade-off between the big 750 billion and a lower budget. So there's a big battle, if you like, between the institutions on that. And that was aired very strongly this week in the Parliament. And the European Parliament, if you like, has to vote through any MFF that is agreed. So while this week is very important, and I would hope that there will be a breakthrough, I think it's not guaranteed because there are so many different issues that different member states will want to raise, including conditionality on these loans or grants around rule of law, you know, which are important, and all of the groups in the Parliament would be in support of that. So I think that they'll have a long meeting.
Well, I suppose it does illustrate the value of having the Taoiseach there in person rather than doing it by video conference, because there'll be so many meetings in the margins and bilaterals where they try to hammer out different compromises and then only bring them all back into the room when the full package is on the table, so to speak.
Yeah, no, I've heard different opinions this week as to whether there will really be a deal, because there's almost too much detail to be worked out at one meeting. Perhaps they'll, you know, extend over a number of days, or indeed they might come back during the summer. And I think some of the leaders have said that if that is necessary, then that will be done.
Sure.
Because we're really into, I mean, if things don't, you know, go along at pace, we're very close to the autumn and we don't have a budget fix. So that would be quite difficult. And on top of that, we haven't mentioned Brexit. Mm. And I think one of the interesting things to come out of this week's proposal from the president of the European Council, Charles Michel, is that he wants to have a 5 billion euro fund for a Brexit. So those regions and sectors, and that would presumably be Ireland, and I think Belgium as well, would have a dedicated fund to help us through whatever happens when it comes to the future. And again, on Brexit, if you look at what the Commission is saying, I'm just looking at a document in front of me, getting ready for changes and communicating to businesses the need for them to realise that even if there's a deal, there will be change. And if there's no deal, there will be significant change. So I think that is one issue that the leaders will also discuss, including discussing implementation of the withdrawal agreement. And I think that the Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, this morning on British television...
Yeah, he told Andrew Marr that he fully believes that there will be a deal and that he basically it's unthinkable that there wouldn't be a deal. That's slightly more optimism than a lot of people would have.
Well, I think I'm not sure if he said the particular about the future. Perhaps he did. And if that is the case, I think he's right that he should show optimism. But thus far in the negotiations, we know that the two sides are far apart. They held their first face-to-face meetings in recent days. So I think, again, that is positive. But the level of ambition, if you like, for an agreement between the EU and the UK is vast. The gap is huge. So in other words, there's still a lot of, you know, discussion to be had about where are we going to land on this. But we're not taking our eye as a parliament of implementation of the withdrawal agreement among citizens' rights and on the Irish protocol. And again, we're getting a lot of concern from sectors who are worried about how is this going to be implemented. And the UK haven't quite outlined fully how that will be done, but they're a separate strand of negotiations. So I think never before has Europe faced quite major negotiations, two layers on Brexit, four or five layers on the money side of things, not to ignore the public health issue, which is still front and centre of the EU agenda. So certainly Micheál Martin is taking over as Taoiseach at a really, really busy time, a very difficult time.
The one great elephant in the room in the midst of all of this is that a lot of the money, whether it's loans or grants or any other sort of financial handouts from Brussels, they generally tend to come with some terms and conditions. And we know that in particular, the French are talking about digital taxes, which is something that Ireland's been quite loath about. Is there a real danger that in order to be able to access not only the loans and grants, but also future money out of the EU budget, that Ireland is going to have to make further compromises, particularly on areas of taxation, and we'll find ourselves having to hand over a lot of the competitive advantages this country has in order to get the same assistance that every other member state will get?
No, I don't think that that will happen at all. I think even the new president of the Eurogroup, Pascal Donohue, answered to that point. But what is happening is a discussion on own resources. So there is a likely to be a plastic levy introduced next year, which would fund own resources of the European Union, possibly to repay those loans we spoke about.
So, sorry, when you say own resources, you basically mean some sort of like indirect taxes which would fund the EU directly rather than national governments.
Exactly. Yeah, and in particular fund the repayment of grants, because obviously the countries that get grants won't have to repay, but somebody has to repay. So that would be part of the thinking. The other element would be carbon budget adjustment levy, which has to meet all sorts of international standards, but it is on the table for discussion. And the third is this digital tax, digital levy. And when it comes to Ireland's position on taxation and on digital companies, you know, we stand our ground, we make our case, but the world is also evolving. And I think there will be a lot of discussion around these issues, but there will be nobody forced to do anything against their own interests. And that's why the discussions next week will have a number of countries. We call them the Frugal Four, you know, including the Netherlands, Austria, Sweden and Denmark, who are, you know, very, very anxious that there isn't, if you like, this giveaway of money borrowed by Europe to countries. They're very much of the mind that you should, if you get money, you repay money. So each member state will come to this meeting with a different agenda.
Sure.
But overall, I think the Chancellor Merkel, you know, talks about together for Europe's recovery. And I think that perhaps in one sense, she is the one leader, because of her experience, who will be, if you like, capable of guiding all of these different agenda points towards some form of agreement.
Is there not an inherent contradiction, though, Marie? Can I put it to you that if you're suggesting that, you know, a lot of loans or grants that the European authorities won't be willing to pay them out unless there is a fair chance of repayment, then first of all, that sort of creates a kind of an entry mechanism or some sort of entryist policies where some of the worse off countries might not be able to access them in the first place because of doubts about their credit worthiness. But also then that the terms and conditions of repayment or the terms and conditions of access may involve the suggestion of having to, you know, implement stuff that might be positive, like elements of the Green New Deal, but also elements that might not be so welcomed, like harmonisation and corporate tax bases.
Well, I mean, you could speculate on that. But in fact, I would read it the opposite way. I mean, if Europe was being, you know, very cautious, it would say we're not giving grants, we're giving loans. So there's no doubt that Italy and Spain, I mean, in one sense, they give us the warning. They were hit by the pandemic first and we all learned from their sad experience. So they have got to be helped out and grants will go their way. But it isn't just that money will be given over with no, if you like, account taken of where it's spent. And indeed, the Parliament has set out its idea that the Parliament has to have oversight of spending. It needs to go into projects, I suppose, that will, you know, build resilience, first of all, in the member state, work to the green agenda that you mentioned, and also around the digital agenda. But the idea of pumping money into an economy that is devastated by the pandemic makes sense. And I don't think there's anyone disagrees that we need a massive package to kickstart the European economy. And equally, those countries that are cautious, I think they understand that if Europe's economy fails and fails to recover, that their own economy will not be helped. So in other words, there's a collective interest in the recovery of the European economy, which everybody will buy into.
Okay. If there is collective interest into all of that, and if you don't believe that there is going to be any terms and conditions around domestic reforms to access a lot of these funds, does that not seem to undermine some of the rationale or some of the explanation that came from government quarters around why it was such a good thing for Pascal Donoghue to be president of the Eurogroup? Because he was seen, and it was being portrayed in some quarters here in Ireland at least, that he was now going to be this bastion, this kind of defender of Irish sovereignty, that he wasn't going to allow the terms and conditions of European funds to get in the way of that. Are you saying that all of that is a kind of a false pretense?
I didn't read any of that, but I think you're misinterpreting what I'm saying. I don't think the grants will be given just in and transferred to a bank account and nobody look at what happens to them. There will, of course, be a requirement that the money is well spent. And I think that's prudent, as it should be. And that it is not, if you like, invested. For example, we don't want to see this money invested in oil or coal or those kinds of technologies of the past. We want it to be invested in the future. In relation to Pascal Donoghue's position, I mean, it is so good that he succeeded, because he is from a small member state, and it's not always easy for small member states to get to that level. But what he will be and what he is a bridge between countries. He's very able to negotiate the territory, and he's also well versed in what the issues are from an Irish point of view. And I think it is good that he's there at this time, because I think the previous Taoiseach Leo Varadkar had addressed the issue around this recovery fund, that Ireland would have expected more than was currently on the table, given the sensitivities around Brexit, etc. And that has now been addressed. So, I mean, I think no matter who is in what position in Ireland, and we hopefully will have a new director or chief executive of the European Medicines Agency, who's also Irish, I think it does help us, because it gives us visibility. It gives us, if you like, a place where we can navigate and negotiate with others. And it shows that small member states have a really important role to play, sometimes a more pivotal role, because they can work between the larger ones and find compromise. So I think it's great that Pascal is there, and I wish him every success.
Okay. Interesting times, Marie. We'll let you go. Thanks so much for giving us that comprehensive rundown of everything that's coming up in Brussels in the next couple of weeks. Certainly busy times. Marie McGuinness is First Vice President of the European Parliament.